Hey everybody, welcome back to 10% True. Just before you get stuck into this episode, I wanted to let you know that in 2024, I'm going to be republishing my book, Red Eagles, America's Secret MiGs. That's the story of the 4477th Test and Evaluation Squadron and the program Constant Peg that exposed American fighter air crew to secretly acquired and operated MiGs in the Nevada desert in the 1970s and 1980s. The book's been out of print for a while. It goes for crazy prices online, but I'll be republishing as a softback exclusively through my website, 10%true.com. If you're thinking about supporting the channel, you'd like to buy the book for yourself or even as a gift, please do go and place a pre-order. I'll put a link in the description. All pre-orders are going to be 25% off, and I'll make sure I personally inscribe and sign your copy for you. Anyway, I'll let you get back on with enjoying this episode. Take care. Nick, welcome back to 10% True. Thanks for joining us on the channel again.
Thanks for having me back. Delighted to be here.
So the last time we were talking, we were rudely interrupted by a technical error, a technical fault, which meant that you were kind of talking about the Tornado's defensive techniques and tactics and the way the aeroplane could protect itself about from being bounced by enemy fighters. And that had transitioned naturally into a conversation about low level. And then you had just referenced your time flying the Tornado in Iraq in the late 90s and early 2000s as part of the no-fly zone missions that were being flown at that time. And so that's where I'd like to pick up again, if we can. But before we did that, I did want to ask you a little bit about the learning points that had come out of Operation Granby, which was the RAF's name for Desert Storm and Desert Shield in 1991, when the RAF had lost a number of Tornadoes and they'd shifted from the low altitude option to a medium altitude option. And at the time you were going through training to become a frontline Tornado pilot, that wasn't too distant from when that operation had taken place. So what was being said in the crew, and what sort of tactics had changed? What were the learning points that had come out of Operation Granby and were being implemented when you were going through the program?
Yeah, it's interesting because when I went through the weapons conversion unit in 97, they were still teaching us legacy ballistic weapons. So we were trained on the free 4,000 pounder, retarded 1,000 pounder, cluster bombs, and even still JP-233. And obviously, one of the limitations of JP-233 is that you have to fly straight and level for a given period of time whilst the submunitions are dispensed. And obviously, in a low-level environment over a heavily defended airfield, that's hazardous to your health. So it didn't really impact us being trained on the weapon. So we still had that training. I think more than anything, it was the how predictability could be really, you know, a bad thing. So if you're number eight in the train following the same ground track, go figure, they know where you're coming from and where you're going to. So they can have the AAA dialed into the right altitude and the right place, and you're going to walk it through all of that. But as for the syllabus, really, I don't remember much being said in that regard. I think the syllabus that we were taught was very much a means to an end. So it taught us the delivery profiles, and you know how to plan for those weapons, how to achieve the over target separation that you needed to avoid being fragged by the weapons for the guy in front, things like that. So, but we did have quite a few of the instructors who had served in Op Granby, and you know I then went on to serve my first tour on 617 Squadron, the Dambusters. One of the flight commanders had been hit by a SAM. He was doing a medium level attack and he was towards the end of the train. I can't remember if he was hit by an SA-2 or an SA-3. They got away with it, but with the battle damage inspection that was carried out, I think the senior supervisor that did the inspection said, wouldn't count on getting thrust reverse on landing because the back end of the aircraft had been well peppered. The fragmentation from the warhead detonation had peppered the back end, you know, all the thrust reverse buckets, the tailorons and things like that. So, that's the kind of the big takeaway. I think, yeah, just the understanding the limitations of the syllabus, but I don't think that much had changed, honestly. Lessons identified probably were carried over into the tactics manual, or the what was called the QEM at the time, which Conventional Weapons Employment Manual, that kind of had the lessons identified, distilled down. But I think they recognized, okay, for the ab initio coming through, let's keep it simple. We'll produce a defined product which the frontline can then go on and mold.
So tell us a bit then about the, I'd like to come back to the sort of the nuts and bolts of flying the Tornado later, if that's okay.
Of
We've
course, yeah.
kind of we started talking about Triple TE, and you talked a little bit about the mechanics of the aeroplane and some of the systems in the aeroplane. And it would be good, it's kind of a weird way to do it, but it would be good to hear about flying the aeroplane and your time on operations, and then maybe come back and explore in detail some of the components like the TFR and the weapons delivery system, and a bit more about how you work with the NAV to get bombs on target. But for the moment then, can we just stick with talking about taking the aeroplane on operations? Before we hit record again this time, I was talking to you about the fact I was talking to JP Peters, John Peters, who was flying his first combat mission in Desert Storm when he was shot down. I think it was on the 17th. And you'd said that you'd had a flight commander who'd also been shot down. And he had sort of given you a briefing on the sort of, the being captured part of that experience. And I just wondered how you approach that. So if you're going to go into combat and there's the possibility you may end up on the ground, you may end up being captured, is that something that you actually spend time embracing in the sense that you think about it and you figure it out in your mind? Or is that something that actually you push to the back of your mind and say, I'll deal with that when I get to it?
Personally speaking, and it's not something I really heard anybody else talk about, I just wanted to make sure I knew my kit. So the survival radio that we carried, making sure I knew how to access the the frequencies to turn the beacon on, things like that. We had a GPS in the combat survival waistcoat that we were wearing, just making sure you knew how to operate that stuff, because I figured that if you had a bad enough day that you'd had a Martin Baker let down into hostile territory, the last thing you needed to be concerned about is how to work the kit. And certainly, I think that's pretty widely promulgated as a lesson identified from conflicts past, and the debrief points from people who've ejected. You must know your kit. So I took that kind of stuff fairly seriously, and I would have a play with the handheld GPS and the radios, go and talk to our life support guys, that we call them squippers in the Royal Air Force, but go and have a talk to them and say, oh, can I take one of the radios out the back and just have a play with it? So I took that kind of thing fairly seriously. Honestly, when it came to the first trip, generally for, of any of the op detachments, and I did quite a few, some before the Second Gulf War and some over Iraq, dealing with a counterinsurgency. Generally, before the first flight, not necessarily the greatest night's sleep you ever had, but once you get into the flow of things, you settle down and go, yeah, I know this. And I think maybe before the first mission, you're just aware of, okay, there's lots of stuff I need to remember from your induction briefs, the spins, which are the special instructions, including the combat search and rescue ones. There's a lot sort of bouncing around your head, but having kind of done the work, I think it just gives you confidence in your kit, and I think that's the way to go. I'm sure we'll kind of come onto it later, but I did have to eject, and after all those years of doing the parachute drills and effectively chair flying an ejection, I just did what I'd been trained, and it worked. So I think that's the key to success. You hear stories about, unfortunately, the Scott O'Grady shoot down. He'd been shot down. He comes running out to the helicopter waving his gun, and unfortunately, he wasn't shot by the CSAR crew picking him up, because they go, okay, he looks like he's wearing US Air Force uniform and he's smiling, so we're not going to shoot him. So, but that's an example of how not to do it. He got away with it, that's fine. But I just figure you need to do what's expected of you, and you become predictable and less of a threat. So yeah.
Just give us a little bit of detail then in terms of what you were flying. So, Iraqi Freedom was March 19th, 2003. Were you flying before that or during that?
So I flew my first operational detachment out of Inchalik in 1998, in sort of January of 98. Alas, I didn't cross paths with Star Baby. What a great guy, and he's a tough act to follow on this channel. But yeah, that was my first detachment. So we were doing basically reconnaissance. Interestingly, that was not a job that we trained for much in the UK, and it was medium level. So we were flying with what was called the Vicon pod at the time. It's wet film, just standard optical camera. And the way this system worked is that we could either fly directly overhead a target or with a certain amount of standoff with the pod looking 60 degrees or 40 degrees. So best kind of resolution generally was either a 60 or a vert, and the software would take care of that sort of standoff. And I think the origins of the software were from the GR1A, the tactical reconnaissance version of the Tornado. So just to spin it back ever so slightly, the interesting thing was that before doing that, my combat ready workup or mission qualification training, I think the USAF call it, had none of that. All the training we did was high intensity war fighting, member of a four ship against a radar threat, or 2v1 low level. It was none of it was this stuff that we were doing at medium level. Interestingly, one of the aspects of that we didn't have the pods back in the UK, so most of the pods were in theatre. We had maybe one or two back in the UK, and they went to the squadron that was next preparing to go on detachment. But actually, it worked. Most of the mechanics of flying a recce run from the front seat was just about acquiring a track, and we were used to doing that by flying the TFR, so the terrain following radar. Guidance cues, and then just keeping the wings level. So the slightly different techniques were you keep the wings level because obviously that affects the where the pod is pointing. And then if you needed to make any sort of lateral adjustment, you just stomp on the rudder to effectively skid the aircraft onto track if you needed to, if the wind changed or for whatever reason you got an indication that you weren't exactly on track. So from the back seat, a lot of it was really, once you'd done the planning, it was about starting the tape at the right place, pressing an event marker at the right place, and then switching the camera off when the run was completed. So we'd start the run with maybe 10 miles to run or something like that. And if it's a point target, you maybe event at 1 mile or event at 0 miles to the point of interest, and then switch the camera off. And if it was a line search, which we would try and do, we try and join the dots. Then you'd hit event markers as you passed the particular points of interest. Then they might have been like at 5, 3, and 1 nautical miles to go to this notional point of interest. You just hit event marker in the back to cue the RIC, that's the Recon Intelligence Center, and the photographic interpreters there to as to where to look on the film. So I know it sounds slightly unusual to say the least that we didn't do much in the way of training before going on ops, but I think the attitude really was, well, if you can do this high intensity stuff, this other stuff is a breeze. And actually, yeah, it was a non-event for the most part. We were well protected. Certainly the Northern Watch, as I'm sure to Star Baby would testify, is a pretty small AOR. We had a lot of protection. We weren't in the AOR for very long. And it just generally worked out. So the way we flew the missions, we'd have if we were dispatching a four ship, one and three would be doing the recce runs, and two and four would be flying cross cover for them. So obviously the people on the recce runs are fairly predictable, and their eyes in, making sure they're flying the track that's required or operating the recce pod. But for two and four, the idea is to be stepped above and laterally displaced, looking through the aircraft doing the run to make sure that there's nothing coming up directly beneath them, because you can't weave or clear any dead zones when you're flying the run. So we were there really as cross cover. So yeah, that's pretty much how the detachment worked. I mean, I think Star Baby's covered it pretty much. Get airborne out of Inchalik, maybe 45-minute transit to the AOR. Before entering the AOR, we take on some gas, and then the whole mission, by the time we finished it, was probably 2.5 hours, something like that. That was pretty much a solid trend for what I've seen in my logbook. Before heading back to Inchalik, we didn't need to refuel on the way home. So
What were you photographing?
So generally speaking, it was areas of interest that, if there were changes, would signify a change in posture from Saddam Hussein's army. You know, obviously we were there to protect the Kurds, or that was what we were there for. We were flying over northern Iraq, so that's the deal. And they figured if there was any change in posture, that maybe barracks would show an absence of equipment or material that would say, okay, well, if it's gone from there, where has it gone? So yeah, we were doing that, and that was really the main thing, looking for change. And of course, you know, if there was a threat reaction from, you know, Saddam's army, air force, or whatever, that you know, under the ROE of self-defense, the inherent right to self-defense, then various other things could happen. You know, be it, you know, the OCA shooting down attempts to interdict us, or, you know, shoot at us or lock us up, then they could do something about that. And if we were locked up by a SAM, then again we had CJs or and prowlers to provide jamming support, or you know, a harm shot.
Did you get any activity from their surface-to-air missiles? I mean, in terms of, you know, not necessarily being locked up, but search radar or acquisition radars?
I think there was some search radar and obviously height finding type stuff, which you'd expect from an IADS. I don't remember being locked up. I think one of the things that we had to be mindful of is the ambiguities between certain other transmitters and you know, fire control radars, so that your reaction was appropriate. So, you know, obviously, it's, if you call defending in an area of that's known to produce ambiguities, then you know, that could lead to a response from coalition aircraft which was inappropriate. So, but other than that, I don't remember really much going on. From the atmospherics that I saw in the mass briefs. So, for example, if we were flying on a Tuesday, the mass, if you were the, one of the lead crew, then you would go to the mass brief on the Monday that was looking at, okay, what's the big picture? Where are the points of interest? How are we going to orientate ourselves? Where are the caps going to be? Things like that. The kind of the vibe I picked up from the Eagles, it was a very routine for them. I think the challenge really being to try and stay on your game and avoid being predictable, and treat each mission as like, okay, today could be the day something happens. How do you fight that complacency? So, other than that, I don't remember there being much going on. And every now and again, we did, because we did depend on certain elements of Turkish infrastructure, data links, and things like that. If they were conducting Turkish special missions, then they would pull the link on us, and it would be a down day. Sometimes it would happen at short notice. Sometimes we'd know the day before. So that could also happen. But generally speaking, it was fairly uneventful.
One of the, I suppose one of the sort of unwritten rules from my point of view around this channel is to not really sort of stray into the topic of politics. But I have to ask. It's well known, it's documented, and I've heard it many times before from guys flying out of Incirlik that there would be those down days so that the Turks could take off and bomb the Kurds, the very very people that this was ostensibly set up to protect.
Yeah.
Did you? How did that impact you? Did you have a moment where you felt, you know, what's the point in doing this if you know they're going to just switch everything off, tell us we can't fly, and go and kill these people anyway? Or do you distance yourself from that? Is that part of being a professional military man that you
Yeah.
don't get involved in the politics?
I think generally speaking, the irony wasn't lost on us. But there was nothing we could do to affect it. So, yeah, I think generally speaking, well, that is what you said at the end there. We distanced ourselves from it. It seems completely perverse that that was what was going on. But I think the briefings that we received from our INT staff put us in the picture in terms of what we would call the pole mill, the political military situation, and how the politics of the area played out. And yeah, I mean, we don't know. We never found out, okay, this is what the Turks then subsequently went on and did. And I guess we just had to accept that it was a down day. And obviously that was pretty nice to get a down day. I mean, everyone was very professional about before flying, not partaking of alcohol and things like that. But it was nice because it was an established base. If we knew that there was a down day for everyone, it was nice, or especially if it happened at short notice, it was nice to go to the bar and see other coalition aircrew there and enjoy a beer with them, especially unexpected because people are so careful about it the rest of the time. So yeah, I mean that was the thing, just to kind of spell it out really. When we were at Incirlik, we were lucky to be in the BOQs. That's the aircrew. We were in the BOQs, but our ground crew were not. So, just shout out for the ground crew because they were in fairly well-established tent city, but nonetheless, they were in field conditions whilst we were in BOQs, and yet they still delivered the jets, and that they were really on the case doing the business, I think. So shout out to them, whilst we're in the BOQs.
You mentioned Star Baby and his time on the channel, which has been significant and substantial, all good, and also his time flying Northern Watch. But he did relate, I think, in one of the last episodes we did, the RAF guys who set fire to the trees in the quad.
I remember the story.
You remember the story, but you weren't there for that. Okay, I wonder whether or not you had been there at the
No,
time.
not
So.
me. I mean, the thing is about in terms of the commitment in Northern Watch, then there were various fleets that took it or forces that took it. So at one stage, the Harrier force were out there, the Jaguar force were also out there, and then the Tornado force took it. So for example, in the Tent City, the Harrier engineer set up a bar that was called the Hover Inn. Now, obviously, alluding to the aircraft, but then when we were there, somebody just butchered the sign, and it was called the Horny Vine. So they just ripped the letters out and just moved it around. But various different, why the Horny Vine? I mean, it's just playing anagrams. But yeah, we had different forces that have been there. So the Jags have been there as well, doing the same job. Bottom line, and as to why, I think it might have been to do with Bosnia, maybe, or just commitments in other areas. That the Tornado force was a lot bigger than either the Harrier force or Jaguar force, so we kind of took it on. And whilst there was the Northern Watch commitment, there was also Southern Watch going on out of Saudi Arabia, out of Al Kharj. So, being a much bigger force, we were able to cover both. And eventually, at one stage, we were flying out of Incirlik doing Northern Watch, Southern Watch, out of both Al Kharj and out of Ali Al Salem in Kuwait. The difference being that neither the Turks nor the Saudis would allow offensive weaponry to be carried. So all the offensive weaponry was based out with those countries. So Kuwait allowed us to carry bombs, which is why we were constrained flying Northern Southern Watch to doing just recce, and see counters, as a self-protection, and OCA again, self-protection, because you're only going to fire if you're fired upon or engaged in some other way. So yeah, at one stage we had squadrons in three locations, all doing maybe half squadron detachments flying over Iraq. So when I look at my logbook, I did my first deployment in the January. It wasn't very long, to be fair, but then I was back out in August in Al Kharj. So we had lots of squadrons at that stage, but it was extremely busy time, with lots of time out away from home on operations.
Did you feel like you had made it, in inverted commas, that your journey, from having wanting to do this as a boy through the fast jet training pipeline, all the two holds that you had to go on, the training process, to getting to combat feel as good as you thought it was going to? Did it give you a sense of accomplishment?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think the moment I got the Hamlet feeling, light up the cigar and happened when I was flying out of Ali Al Salem. We were carrying weaponry at that stage, so they had this thing called a response option. An RO1 was effectively an airborne formation. We were sat in a cap. We had a pre-surveyed target, which was cleared by UK government, and we were waiting for some sort of trigger to happen. So if the Kameo going in from elsewhere, from doing recce or whatnot out of Al Kharj, or they had F-16, I think Block 30s out of Ahmed Al Jaber, which is kind of the F-18 base in Kuwait at the time. They were carrying iron as well. But if anyone was shot at, locked up, and effectively tripped the ROE, then the kind of mission commander hosted on the AWACS could say, right, execute. And we were sat in a cap, and we could go on and prosecute the target. Now, quite often these targets were, minor. I struck a KS-19. It's an artillery piece, heavy caliber, but it was well away from any civilian population. As far as I could tell, looking at the tape afterwards, it wasn't being manned at the time. But I think, when I landed, I was actually leading the four ship, and I'm not a forward leader, but it was suitably supervised down there. But it was a pretty straightforward mission, a single line attack. And my Wizzo and I put a couple of bombs into one revetment, and basically had other revetments within the site allocated to other members of the four ship, and we dealt with some of these AAA pieces. So the target was a weapon of war. It was triggered by an offensive act by the Iraqis at the time, but no civilians were at risk at any stage. So I think, when I landed back from that mission, especially having landed it, sorry, especially having led it, I'm taxiing into the HAZ site, and we our Squinto, our squadron intelligence officer, I think she had my camera for whatever reason, and I've got this very grainy photo somewhere of me just, I'm on the chocks, the canopy's open, and just waiting for them to kind of fit the fuel catches before shutting down so that we don't dump fuel on the surface. And it was that, I've done it. The nearest thing I can, explain in terms of an analogy. So imagine being a surgeon, right? And you spent all this time training to carry out an operation of some description that's really important, but you've never had a chance to do it. You never really answered the question, could I keep my cool? Could I do what was asked of me when it mattered most? And yeah, to have that question answered was a big thing. And that was the only weapon I got off in the end. I supported other people, and I'm kind of glad I did what was asked of me. And as best I know, there's no blood on my hands for doing that. Obviously, I was part of other operations where, damage was done and probably life taken, but that I just feel I did everything and kept my cool and did what was asked of me when it mattered most.
Had you thought about that much then, the idea that you would take the life of another person? Is that something you had even thought to?
It's funny because when you're talking about target sets at home, home based training, you might say, okay, what's the target? Is, well, soft skin vehicles, troops in the open, and things like that. And it's very easy to become distanced from the reality. I think targeting pods make it a lot more personal, and I'm sure people have seen various Predator and Reaper cam footage where it's really apparent what's going on. At that stage, we were flying with a tile pod resolution. Wasn't that great. I mean, I think we would have been able to see if there'd been anybody there at the time, but it does provide that sort of standoff and that detachment. And I just, yeah, I think that kind of contemplation is probably best saved for time on your own, and maybe after the event. In the end, it doesn't change the job we have to do. I guess all we can do is be meticulous with following the rules of engagement, especially when it comes to collateral damage stuff or blue on blue. That's the sort of stuff that would haunt you for the rest of your life, I think. I guess, if you put the uniform on, they're doing their job, I'm doing mine, somebody's going to come out second best potentially. So beyond that, I didn't really trouble myself too much with it. But yeah, I think if you start to think, well, they had a mum and a dad, I think it would be a lot harder. And I would just, say really for the soldiers on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan, those guys and girls, they deserve full respect for what they did, because I think it's a lot harder. What they did is very up close and personal. I think we had an easy ride of it, honestly.
you know, I know that you have a family. I won't discuss that. That's for you to tell people about if you want to. But how do you have that conversation with your family? So again, you know, this isn't a million miles from when, you know, tornadoes felt like they were dropping like flies in the early, you know, days of Desert Storm or Granby. And presumably your wife would have been aware of the dangers of what you were doing as a profession in peacetime. But did you are you able to sit down and have a conversation with her about, you know, how to manage anxiety or fear about you getting shot down when you go and deploy on operations? Mm.
So I got married after my first frontline tour, and I was coming to the end of my TAC weapons tour as an instructor when I got married. So she didn't have to deal with me flying over Iraqi-held territory when Saddam Hussein was ruling things. I would say I think we always felt confident that if we flew smart, that things would be fine. I think I would, you know, pay tribute to my mum and dad, because they never bothered me or burdened me with their worries. I wish I'd perhaps been a bit more mindful of their, you know, natural parental anxiety. And I've since kind of gone back to them and said, look, hey, I just went off and did it, and I perhaps didn't really think about how it would have been for you back home. I just explained to them life, that I could control the risk and that it was fine. But, you know, at the stage, that was the stage before FaceTime, before video calls, and we had like a phone card, so we were able to call home from a cubicle. Maybe I think we had 10 or 15 minutes a week, which at the time was less than a prisoner was allowed, and it caused a bit of a stir. But you know, I can remember when I called home and called mum and dad. You know, mum was just absolutely over the moon about, you know, having the call, and, you know, just, obviously you can't talk about operational stuff, but you can talk about the banalities of life outside of the flying, and, you know, what's the flying like? Oh, yeah, it's good, you know, getting lots of hours, and yeah, it's fun, and we're going to the gym, and we're, you know, popping into town occasionally, whatever it is you can talk about. But I never really had that awareness of what it was like for them. So that's my parents. But as far as, you know, my wife, I think it's tough for them, because, and tough in a way that it's hard for us as aviators to fully appreciate, because, you know, we know the risks, you know, but as to what nightmares they entertain when we're away, it's really kind of hard to say, because I can remember I went on operations not long after one of the kids was born. I suppose it doesn't really matter, but it was maybe 4 weeks after, I think it was my son was born. And, you know, you come back and new routines have been established. Anyone who's a parent, you know that having a good routine is key. And you know, but I've been away, so really I come back home and need to try and fit in with the household routine. So my wife is the daughter of an engineer, a warrant officer, GEF engineer. So she was really stoical about it, and yeah, all credit. And again, so I think it's important to recognize all the families of people on operations, because they just kind of soldier on back home with a play setting missing at the table and things like that, and taking care of when the car blows up or the fridge breaks and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, generally, you know, take care of it without bothering, you know, disturbing people on operations too much. So yeah, all credit to them.
When you got back then from this first deployment, what did you do next? Did you go at the end? Because you said you flew with the 617 squadron. I think you said 4 years you were there.
I was, yeah, there 3 years. It was just pretty much a standard first tour, yeah.
Okay. So did you come back from that, just carry on flying continuity training in the UK, and then go back on operations again?
Yeah, very much so. We'll touch on maritime, I guess, at some stage. But I can remember, well, having looked through the logbook recently, that I come back and, yeah, the flying back in the UK was about getting back up to speed with what we call BTRs. That's basic training requirements. So that, you know, with the Tornado being a swept wing aircraft, you have to do so many swept approaches. You know, and there's weaponeering stuff for NATO declarations, getting so many attack profiles done. for a given delivery. And yeah, just kind of getting back to it. And that was kind of the irony, is that okay, we're doing this stuff on operations, but there was quite a clear dividing line to what we did when we came home. And that was really, again, more orientated towards a high intensity war. So I think there was honestly quite a bit of inertia in the training syllabi that we followed. And of course, other people, new people arriving on the squadron, they need workups, and so you might be making up a four-ship for somebody's training objectives as part of their mission qualification training.
So who was the threat in this scenario then, or what was the threat? I mean, when I visited US Air Force squadrons, they usually talk about, Flanker B, AA-10, AA-11. That's the kind of, the standard threat they're going to go up against. What was the standard threat you were going up against in your scenarios?
Scenarios back home would have been MiG-23, Flogger, generally AFIB Bravo, Mirage 3, Magic 2, sorry, not Mirage F1, Magic 2, stuff like that. And again, I think there was again a fair amount of inertia to the threats. It's difficult for us to replicate at the time, to replicate things like MiG-29, because we just didn't have any platforms that could do that. The most agile opponent we could fly against was the Hawk out of 100 squadron, so that was great. I mean, the Hawk was challenging to spot as a much smaller aircraft. It could certainly outrate us, so that kind of brought challenges of its own. But in terms of radar threat, the only people we could really train against was the colleagues at Lucas or Leeming flying the Tornado F3. So sometimes it was just blue versus blue. They had their training objectives, we had ours. Sometimes they would simulate some stuff for us, but generally speaking, or it might be run one would be them simulating red air, and run two, then they're going to be their best blue air. So yeah, that I think that, and the surface threats were generally single digit Warsaw Pact SAMs with a smattering of the French export systems that were also on the market at the time.
So things like Roland and Crotale, that kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
The Tornado, well, I suppose it's not specifically the Tornado, but the Tornado is the platform that I've often heard talked about in this context. It apparently had a very good raw, very capable in terms of its ability to identify threat systems, and it's unclassified. It's in the unclassified manuals that it uses NATO code names for the systems, which is a different model to some. Let's say US Air Force RAW, so the F-15 RAW, for example, might have that for the ground-based threat systems, but it doesn't for air-based threat systems. It uses a series of wing forms, and it doesn't differentiate between a MiG-29 and a Su-27, for example. You just get different wing form. But was that your experience? Did you feel like, from an electronic support measures or electronic protection point of view, that you had a particularly capable system in the airplane?
Couple of kind of spurs to my answer, really. The first of which is that the Tornado, especially on the GR4, had the crate, as it was called, as the box for the avionics for the RHWR, was sat right over the top of some hot air piping associated with the environmental control system. So when the aircraft went from the Tornado 1 to the GR1 to the GR4, it had an upgraded and an adapted environmental control system, and it was not very reliable. So quite often there was a bleed air shutoff valve that had to be replaced, and if they replaced the valve, the aircraft had to fly once, and then they would retorque some clamps on the piping, and that meant that to get access to that piping, the RHWR crate had to be taken out. So that it was quite frequent, or quite often, the case that the aircraft were flying on, a home base without an RHWR. So that was suboptimal, shall we say. I mean, other fleets, for example, as I understand it, the F3 fleet, it was roll, what they call roll equipment, so it had to be fitted, which you can understand for an interceptor doing beyond visual range training and things like that. You have to have an RHWR. It didn't have that same status with us, and I think it was a pity. But when we had it fitted, yes, it was a good piece of equipment, but obviously it's as good as the library that's fitted. So the reality is that coalition platforms, radars operate often in the same bandwidth as a threat system. So there's room for ambiguity in terms of what it's displaying to you. So I think again, having SA is key. I mean, I did a TLP, so the Tactical Leadership Program, and I made a schoolboy error. I got well, my crewmate and I got locked up by something, and it was, I thought it was friendly, but we soaked up a semi-active shot without reacting, which is embarrassing, honestly. But it was, it was ambiguous with other stuff, and I just kind of gone, oh yeah. After so much ambiguity, you start to lower your guard. But of course, the antidote to that is, Vandal one, buddy, or bullseye this, getting spiked from this direction, and AWACS. It's a defensive call. Should go, okay, threat, bra from you. And you go, oh Christ, that's actually a valid threat. I need to do something about it to a notch, or if it's inside a bolt range, then notch, and if not, then try and retrograde to defeat any missile shot kinematically. So that's really what you're up against is ambiguity and having bigger picture SA often from AWACS, because we didn't have a PD radar, we didn't have data link.
And you mentioned earlier, in the same sort of theme as this, that you could visit the Spadadum electronic warfare training range. How useful was that? Again, it's public record. They've got an SA-6 there. I think they've got an SA-8, and they might have some other emulators. But what was that a? Going back to this idea that when you were talking about the low fly in Wales and sort of great local knowledge becomes a big thing, is it the same with that kind of range? It's quite a small range. There's a limited amount of, I guess, threat replication they can do. Is it the sort of thing where it's useful the first couple of trips, but then you kind of get used to know, you kind of know what's coming up, or you get used to it, or do they keep you on your toes? How valuable is that as a training asset?
I think it's invaluable, absolutely, essential training. I think that, you can do stuff in the sim, and that's great, but just seeing ambiguities crop up, or how the angle of arrival can skip around a bit, and how do you fly your counter maneuvers based on that, organizing your cockpit. It's absolutely priceless. I mean, they could move the sets around, so wherever you think it's going to be, it could be somewhere else. I think, I did quite a lot of when I became a squadron QFI, so like instructor pilot, flying the trainer version. I would try, if I was doing maybe an air fueling introduction sortie, we'd go to either Spade Adam having tanked, and then and go in and try and make all the slots line up, and the range would give you tailored training, so you could integrate with the range controller and say, okay, he will tell you, right, this is target acquisition, this is what target tracker looks like, and this is what the missile guidance looks like. So you can do everything from that to a full up, right, we're going to attack a target set in Spade Adam opposed, and we'd like these threats, but as to where they are, that's up to you. And they would provide a full spectrum of training from those two kind of extremes, if you will. So I just thought it was great. And then afterwards, you would get a post-mission report, and you could see what they were recording as their transmissions, what your reaction was. And when you were fully swept up, I like to cue the video to the same timeline, so you can see what they were doing. We didn't have an RHWR playback, so we generally would rely on what was said over the cockpit voice recorder. And you could say, well, okay, spike from this direction. So if I've got a good notch, then it's simply 90 degrees plus or minus that. And did I, when I went into my aggressive maneuver, was I in the notch at that point, if that's what I was trying to achieve? So you could really get into the nitty-gritty of, did you fly enough G? Did you hit the limits? Did you achieve an accurate notch, or stuff like that? So yeah, great facility. Great. I mean, it is a bit tight on airspace, and I don't know how, especially for medium level things, it's quite tricky. And of course, with controlled airspace and airways being next door, you can't just pump chaff out willy-nilly. And I think that, that's an important part of training. It just comes back to habit patterns, doesn't it? You do what you've trained, and if you can't pump the chaff out, you better be touching the button so that your habit patterns and your motor programs are where they need to be. And of course, that's the beauty of the sim, is that you can be fangs out, you can punch tanks off, you can employ your defensive aids to the full extent that you can't do in peacetime with the considerations that we've outlined. So
And you can see in the picture behind me, there's the Storm Shadow pod on the wing. That's the jamming pod. I know you're not going to talk specifics. I'm not going to ask you about those, but just generally, was that a good pod? Could you turn that on and sort of validate for your own edification that the system worked? Was it something that you could really only use in wartime, and therefore you kind of had to rely on the fact the test guys had validated it properly?
They had a training PFM loaded, so a PFM being kind of, it's called pre-flight message, but effectively think of it as the counters and whatnot. So obviously it wasn't broadcasting the trons, as we call them, the counters, in a peacetime environment around Spade Adam or anywhere else. So to a great extent, we did rely on the trials, and the documentation was there for us to look at. As pods go, it did its job. Single digit SAMs, generally speaking, was what it was set up for. And you also needed to know how that interacted with your RHWR. That sort of stuff was really important to know. The position of other jamming assets were, but if a prowler's pushing out jamming to affect a particular system, go figure, your RHWR is going to see that as some sort of emission from a threat system. But if you know where the cap is, you can say, okay, that is friendly jamming, and I can discount that, and I know where I think the SAM site is. Or if it's coming from somewhere else, well, maybe we need to take that seriously. So a good pod, blighted by some unreliabilities. We did have the Sky Shadow 2, and I think really the what you're up against is that for the clearances on the aircraft, it needed to be the same shape and more or less the same weight. So anything that they changed on the inside could improve things, but it still had to be within that shape and size. Otherwise, you're invalidating a lot of the trials that have been done, carriage trials that have been done before. So there were times when, for example, internal coolant stuff made it a bit unreliable. I think things got better as they tried to work on that, but I'm not sure to what extent. I left the force in 2012. That's when I left the military, but I left the front line in 2009. And at that stage, Afghanistan counterinsurgency, that was the kind of the focus point. So that they weren't dealing with radar threats so much as handheld IR SAM. So there was was it the DIRCM, a directed infrared countermeasures pod replaced the Sky Shadow. So I think it lost the imperative, the moral imperative to be updated. I'm sure that they could fit all sorts of new hardware, solid state, computer gizmos inside there, and it could be, much more capable. But I think by the time the aircraft came to the end of its service life, the handheld SAM was still probably the greater threat.
Maybe now is a good time to talk about the maritime role then. So because
Sure.
I from again from our offline conversations, I think you said to me you only did it for a very short period of time, but it was while you were on 617 Squadron.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about that just generally, and then
Yeah.
any specifics that you're able to share?
So the Lost Sea Tornado Wing had the maritime role, and that was taken over from the Buccaneers when they retired. So main difference really between the Tornado and Buccaneers, that the Tornado could only carry two Sea Eagle missiles. The Buccaneer could carry four. They were able to do that because they could put a fuel tank in their internal bomb bay. So we were down to half the weapons load for a start. In terms of the amount of training that we did, generally speaking, I understand it was something like 25% of our training was supposed to be in the maritime role. It generally coincided with naval exercises, one that was run quite frequently from 97 to 2000 when I was there was called JMC, the Joint Maritime Course, and that was run several times a year. I did participate in an exercise out of Sigonella in Sicily, working in the Mediterranean. But generally speaking, it was kind of UK based and support the Royal Navy and other NATO assets. So we didn't do it that often. I think the thing to highlight at that stage in terms of the aircraft, the platform itself, that we the GR1 was not wired up for carrying smart weapons. It was really sort of about ballistic weapons, as I've said, like DUM bombs, JP233, CBUs, and things like that. So dealing with the carriage of Sea Eagle, it had to have a Sea Eagle control panel fitted. So only certain aircraft had that panel fitted. And if you had that panel fitted, it couldn't have the Vicon recce pod control panel, or it couldn't have the TIAR control panel. So the major step forward really with the GR4 was this aspiration to move away from fleets within fleets, obviously using a 1553 data bus. And so instead of relying on hard wiring, you could communicate through the mission computer and through the data bus. So that was one of the limitations. So in terms of, yeah, the training, as I say, kind of effectively associated with an exercise. In terms of mission planning, which as always would start with an update as to where the fleet was, and identification of the critical asset within the fleet. The critical asset tended to be the oiler, so the cargo ship that's going to supply fuel to the other warships in the package or in the fleet. So the reason, obviously, for that, it's generally going to be less well defended in and of itself, not so well armored, and it's a critical node. So that was typically the sort of thing you might go against, but of course there could be a naval directive to target a different part of the sheet of the fleet, whichever vessel was deemed that high value asset. From there, what you've got, the challenge is the fleet is obviously moving in a particular direction and at a particular speed. And generally speaking, for mud moving, certainly in the 90s, it was AI, so air interdiction against a fixed target. You knew the location, you plan your route, taking into account surface-to-air missiles, terrain that you could hide behind, avoiding fighter areas of responsibility, all the sort of standard mud moving stuff. So that initial part would hold good. And you would aim to plan a min-risk routing. And if you needed tanker support, clearly you'd go via the tanker before letting down to low level. After that, you get to what was called the last fixed point. And after that, the software allowed you to have effectively a floating target, and it would accept into the software that mean line of advance of the fleet. So the fleet's heading west at 10 knots, for example. And when you updated that position, it would then continue that rate of progression in the background. So from that point, the aim of us as a maritime strike asset firing anti-ship missiles is to somehow find a way through the picket ships, the destroyers or frigates with capable anti-aircraft or anti-missile defenses, be it close-in weapon systems like you call it a Gatling gun or regular SAMs, try to find a way through them to concentrate our fire on the high-value asset. So the best way to achieve that is effectively fanning out around an arc that's centered on the high value asset. We all fire at the same time. Our missiles all arrive at the same time, excepting that some might be shot down by close-in weapon systems. Some might malfunction, but some will get through. So you're trying to achieve that salvo compression. So this is where the third-party queuing came in, really. Most of the time, Nimrod MR2, using their sensors, but it could be a Breguet Atlantique or any a P3 Orion from the Dutch Navy, providing what we called SERPIX or surface picture. Effectively, this is a broadcast on a running loop saying, okay, this is where the high value asset is, and they're at the center of like a compass rose. And so from this bearing at this range is this type of ship. And they it was a way of describing the disposition of the fleet. So the role of the lead pilot, oh, sorry, the lead crew, and specifically the lead navigator, because really a lot of this was hosted in the back seat of the Tornado. His role and his decision was to try and choose a line of attack that was going to give the missiles the best chance of getting through, and communicating that to the rest of the formation. As a front seater, your main job really is to fly as low as you can, because you need to try and stay below the radar horizon as long as you can. So fly as low as you can, don't hit the water, maintain cross cover between us in case there's a fighter threat out there, and try and keep some big picture essay. But a lot of it really was hosted in the back seat, as they would make their tactical decisions and input the data and slew the attack access to the best available. So we get to this last fixed point, and then if you could imagine the formation maybe arriving in card, so like a pair of aircraft, and then behind them a pair, then that we might split out. So one and two go left and right, three and four, or three will go the same way as one, and you end up around, arcing around the enemy formation of ships, and then turning inbound to fire. There was a logic that you could set on this on the control panel that would get the missile to pick a particular response or a return if it saw a cluster of returns, and so there would be some deconfliction on that. So for real, of course, we turn in, hit the range that we wanted to fire at, and fire our missiles, and then obviously turn away. For real, I think we'd be switching radars off and try to minimize our emissions as much as possible, because naval assets are very good at listening out for radars, even radars or air-to-air TACAMs or any of that sort of stuff. So we try and make our approach as covert as possible. But having fired, then it's simply a case of turning away and let the missiles do their thing. In training, of course, and this was the fun part, is you become the missile. So we were able to fly a profile that replicated the missile, and at a certain range, the navigators would turn on their radar a certain scan within a certain range scale, and the radar marker would say, right, this is where the Sea Eagle missile was expecting a target, and you'd follow the logic that was set to the control panel, and then insert on that particular target. So for us in the front seat, the target bars would jump, and we would just fly to that. So it was quite satisfying having hit the fire point. You'd have lost visual with your other formation members, but as you close in, simulating the missiles, you start to see these other jets left and right of you as we all converge on the target to work out, hey, did you hit? Would you have targeted the right vessel? And it wasn't easy. Obviously the ships could be manoeuvring. I certainly would if I knew there were Sea Eagles coming in. I'd be changing the force disposition as much as I could. So we got to that point, and then you'd overfly the target and work out, yes, would it have been a hit or would it not? And after that, it became what we called ASMD, so anti-ship missile defense training, or commonly known as ship dicking. It was fun, and this is something the Buccaneer guys were really good at. The whole thing they were really good at, because they just did a lot more of it than we were required to at the time. So if you were flying with an ex-Buccaneer backseater, they were really, really very good at this whole mission set. But yeah, the anti-ship missile defense was simply flying low and fast past the ships and watching them try and turn to bring their weapon systems to bear. So it's pretty impressive seeing destroyers, at flank speed, heeling over as they try and evade us, or at least bring their weapon systems to bear. So we would do that for probably 5 or 10 minutes. And then clear off home. As a safety factor to kind of take into account, of course, destroyers and that lot have ships, sorry, have helicopters doing ASUW or ASW missions. And when you're flying in towards the fleet at 150 feet, you're kind of in the same piece of sky as those platforms. So there had to be a safety call to the fleet to say that this is us inbound. So slightly artificial, but they would clear it in, and by that stage they would have made sure the helicopters were all on deck, so there was no deconfliction issue at all. So overall, I would say it was a fun mission. I enjoyed it because it was dynamic, and it required some thinking on the feet, mostly in the back seat. And our job really, as I say, was trying to follow along to keep the big picture essay going. Okay, the fleet's like that. I'm coming in from here. And how is it going to look in terms of the split and rejoin? As part of the training, we had to do the usual slide recce for ships. But of course, if you're close enough to ID, a warship. Okay, it's Warsaw Pact. It's a destroyer. Oh shit! It's got a pretty capable. It's got maritime SAAs or something like that. You're firmly within the wares at that point. But that was nonetheless part of the training. But yeah, it was fun to do. And let's say it was 617 and 12 squadrons that were assigned that role.
So, to be clear then, through the process of running in and hitting your final point and targeting the Oyola or whichever ship it was that you were being expected to sink, where possible, you did that through data link then. So you used P3, MR2, whatever it was, to tell you where those ships were, and you weren't using your ground attack radar to locate them in on the sea surface.
It was much more low tech than that. It was simply an HF radio broadcast.
Oh.
So it was just a loop over the radio. So the great thing about the HF, and it's not a side to the Tornado that's kind of talked about that much. It's not that it's classified or anything, but obviously having long range radios was a quite considerable benefit. So I can remember being in the HAZ listening to a Serpik broadcast from Nimrod, which is great because I could kind of plot out an initial disposition just on a blank piece of paper with a compass rose on it. Obviously, that's less well advised if you're flying at 100 feet or 150 feet. But yeah, it's really old school over the radio, HF at long range, and it may even be a VHF, closer range. Of course, you'd be subject to all well, the maritime patrol aircraft would be subject to jamming. Of course, they would be doing their best to interfere with that sort of stuff.
I'm not. I really know nothing about sort of surface warfare or anything navy oriented, to be honest with you. But I do know that sometimes these fleets are trying to. They're under a mission control. They don't want to be located electronically. I'd imagine there are other times where they're actually quite happy to broadcast, and they've got everything turned on, and they're looking to make sure no one comes up and sneaks up on them. What would the implications of both of those scenarios to you then, and because you mentioned Naval SA-8, and I don't know anything about Sea Eagle, and I know you're not going to talk ranges for the missile, but I would have expected that they could outrange you, and so I wonder whether or not you would, if they were transmitting and broadcasting and they had everything turned on and you were getting spiked, whether or not that meant you probably couldn't prosecute your attack as well, or it meant that sort of the risk levels significantly increased because of a technical overmatch. What can you say about that?
Generally speaking, the Sea Eagle had a pretty good range. So for the single digit maritime SAMs, or their equivalent, because the nomenclature was slightly different. I can't remember the numbers, but like a Naval SA-3 was called SAN something, and it was a bigger number. We could get weapons away before we were inside the engagement zone. But typically, what you would see is the RHWR was pretty quiet running in, and then I think they realised when the game was up. And after that, there's no point in maintaining MCON. Gaining fire solutions from their own weapon system became their priority. In terms of training with NATO ships, that's where the ASACs seeking came in handy because by hovering at 5,000 feet or whatever, I'm not sure what altitude they operated at, but they're extending their radar horizon. They could also be offset or remote from the fleet and be emitting, but without compromising the exact location of the fleet. Now, clearly, if we were able to work out where that is, we know as a helicopter, it can't be that far from the fleet. But to my knowledge, at the time, I don't remember the Warsaw Pact or the Soviet Union or Russia indeed having any comparable capability. They were relying on their masthead radars. And I don't know to the extent that how good their MCON would be or the ESM picking up our emissions. I think training against blue assets, we had to be at on our A game and do our best. Peacetime rules, you couldn't sort of turn off rad alt and things like that, because then effectively you're trying to visually fly down 100 feet. But that would be an acceptable risk in wartime, but not in training, not training, not in peacetime. So yeah, that's overall my take. We pretty good weapon, gave us enough standoff. I think if you were talking about navalized SA-10 or any of those sort of double digit stuff, then I think it would become more challenging. And of course, what's the radar horizon? I honestly, it depends on the mast height of the ship, what range they could see us. But if we'd be doing our best to fire at a range that would ensure the PK, but would keep us out of the engagement zone.
Did you have to, if it's not a stupid question, did you have to do this for real?
No. There were a few high seas firings towards the end of the life of the missile, but it was rare to even carry it. I mean, there's quite a nice photo out there, open source, of a Nimrod MR2 and two jets, one from 617, one from 12, both carrying a pair of Sea Eagles. So the high seas firing was, I think, out to the west of Saxa Ford, that neck of the woods. Were out to the west of the Hebrides in one of the danger areas there, and they fired Sea Eagles into an old destroyer. But I think it's probably as part of an end-to-end weapon system test. But it was like rocking horse poo to get a chance to fire Sea Eagle, and I think it was the same with Martel, which, was, as I understand, was the predecessor. So.
So it wasn't like, if you think of all the air defense scrambles out of Lucas or Lossie for Russian bears coming trolling the British Isles, it wasn't like their fleet, their surface vessels did the same sort of thing where they came along and you had to go out there and let them know, hey, we're here, we can
That
see
would
you.
have been very interesting. I've seen, obviously there were photos open source of the fleet coming down through the channel, and they would have been shadowed by the Royal Navy some way out, and by either submarines covertly, I imagine, or when it's really obvious, then there'll be a frigate operating reasonably close. But we never had that opportunity that I can recall. I think there would have been opportunities seized, but it wasn't in the time that I was there. Things were pretty quiet. The Russian Navy was in the doldrums when I was there. I can remember reading the Sunday Times magazine, and they were showing what an appalling state the Navy was in, and submarines rusting in some of the ports. People, got the washing lines out on the submarine. They had nowhere to live, no barracks. There was just no money. So I think at the time, it wasn't really a credible threat.
That's 25% of what you were doing on the squadron then. Were there any other specific missions, specific roles that you were training for? One thing I haven't asked about is whether or not the RAF still had a tactical nuclear mission at the time, or if that was something you were doing too.
So the when I hit the front line, the only people doing the strike workup were guys at the based at Bruggen. So there were four squadrons based there. They were still doing strike workups, but QRA had finished, I think, around 88. So quick QRA being quick reaction alert. So NATO, like a aircraft dinner has loaded up with live weapons, standing alert, ready to scramble. That sort of thing had finished by the well before the time I even joined the Air Force. So I think they still did some of the workup, but the switchology, the control boxes for the strike weapons had gone. I mean, I remember flying one of the Treble T airplanes, and they still had the BRSLs, I think it's bomb release safety. Can't remember what the L is, but yeah, they still had the switchology in the back seat. But it had been decommissioned, or it was just the legacy equipment. So nobody did any kind of formal kind of a workup for that, as far as I know, beyond maybe some initial ground school and a couple of singleton missions.
You left a comment on one of the YouTube videos on the channel about, and I, so I wonder whether or not it was related to that. Maybe it wasn't, but you left a comment saying that at points the RAF didn't trust the guys in the front to know everything in case they went rogue. What? So that is
Ah,
that
right.
what?
No, so this is kind of more about force culture and more about CRM in terms of operating the Tornado, which I can get to now if you like, because it covers a bit of force culture. And so it wasn't related to strike. It was really more about how was the information displayed, how did the team, the crew work together as a team.
You can do that now. I mean, if you feel that's a natural place to do it, or if you want, we can put it in towards the end where maybe you do some of your reflections on, because I know that there are some other things you want to talk about around things that could have been done better and so on and so forth. So it's up to you, Nick, whatever feels natural to you.
Yeah, I think I can just go and allude to it briefly here, because I think there's the thing to highlight is there was a difference in the way the GR1 was operated to when I returned from my TAC weapons tour, my fighter lead-in tour in 2000, 2001. I basically say that in my first tour flying the GR1, a lot of it was operated very similar to the way the Buccaneer was operated, or at least the way I assume it was operated, because I understand that airplane had a pretty sketchy INS. A lot of what was done was using map and stopwatch and looking out the window. So the navigators really did navigate, and the front seaters had a didn't even have a low flying chart, as I understand it. We didn't in the front seat of the Tornado. So yes, we had the projected map display, and it was just a repeater of the back seat. So it had a low flying chart, but no track line annotated to it or anything like that. The challenges this brought is that you could be part of a four-ship plan, and your job as one of the pilots typically would be maybe doing the target plan on a 50 thou map and on a survey map, obviously dealing with the detail of the attack. But the navigators would have been sorting out the over target separation and sorting out a min risk routing and all that sort of stuff. And you just don't get to see the route before the brief. So you're sat 20 feet away from the map in the briefing room, trying to go, okay, we're going to go down there, down there, down there. Just trying to get the geometry of the route in your head. Because if you get bounced or threatened, you need to know the cut short. Where can I cut short? Where am I gonna? Can I cut across that leg, or will I be going through a mez or a peacetime constraint like a glider sight or a light airfield, something like that? So it was very much pilots drove. We did the radios on tower, so local air traffic. We did range primary. But after that, the radios were done in the back seat. So like area radar, AWACS, all that sort of stuff, they would be doing. And it was just kind of hard sometimes to memorize stuff. The big picture essay, that what they didn't want is you picking up the map. Well, they go, you can just ask me. At the time felt that the Strike Eagle approach of everyone has equal access to information, as we understood at the time, that's the way to go. And that, lo and behold, is the way that pretty much the Tornado went subsequently. But what it took was a change in the hardware, in the sense that we instead of this microfiche map, we then got a digital display which gave us the route depicted on it, and it also gave us what we called the egg, which was if you were on speed and on time, where you would be on the track line. So if you were trying to rejoin, you just basically sorted a visual intercept on this egg as it marched around the route. And we could also then select other screens, including latterly the targeting pod. So the issue really was, we don't want everyone eyes in. Somebody needs to be eyes out. And but what happened was that I think the workload in the back seat just got higher and higher, to the point that they had to export some of the work forward, some of the monitoring. And I think that was long overdue, honestly. And the culture changed. So I think the way to go is to kind of train. If you're OLFing, so that's the 100-foot flying, right? You are not looking at the map. You're flying as low as you dare. You've got the steering cue and the head-up display. You're going to follow that, fine. But you're doing that only for as long as you need to, because you're threat reacting, either ducking to avoid a fighter or trying to terrain mask against a surface-to-air missile system or a AAA system or something like that. So you fly at the height that allows you to look around more, or okay, what's coming up? Oh yeah, we said we were going to do our pre-attack checks on that leg or something like that. So yeah, the dynamic changed. So when I alluded to my comment is that we weren't trusted to, I think that was the vibe I picked up. They didn't want pilots making autonomous decisions and cutting the nav out of the loop. Now, you'd like to think any reasonable professional would not go off making unilateral decisions unless it was time sensitive or safety related. I think it spoke more to insecurities. I'm sorry to be direct about it to my nav brethren, but I think it was more that than anything else. And as time went on, CRM allowed us to do more stuff in the front seat. Like, for example, one of the software upgrades allowed us to adjust the steering, like step the steering onto another waypoint, which had always been a nav a nav thing. Don't do that. Don't do it without touching, but without telling them. But you could think, okay, we're running late. The demanded ground speed is stupidly fast, and I'm not going to be able to crack that. So I need to, because I've now got my map. I can see if I just head over to the next waypoint and skip one, I'll be back on time. Brilliant! I can do that. And as long as I told the guy or girl in the back, then it was going to be fine. So it's just about establishing that trust and that rapport. And whoever's got the highest SA at any given point in time has an opportunity, or at least a control available to them, to manipulate the mission computer or any other subsystem, to best effect for the crew.
I wonder often about the atrophying of skills and the ability to do mental arithmetic and stuff while flying. And you talked in part one about the fact you'd come back from the tornado. You went to be an instructor at the TAC weapons course, and as your German instructor had described to you, you'd become a bit of a hard cripple, and your visual scan had gone away, and you had to relearn that. When you're flying in an aeroplane where actually really all you're doing is just you're going towards where the guy in the back's telling you to go towards, and he's running everything, do those sort of airmanship skills begin to atrophy because you're just, I don't want to sound make it sound like you're sat there fat, dumb, and unhappy, because obviously you're making sure you don't fly into the ground, and there's various other things you're doing, but you're not working the radios, you're not doing the nav, you're not working the weapon systems. Presumably, he's doing the fuel calculations, all those sorts of things. So does that lead to you becoming a lesser pilot as a result? Did the GR4 and the fact that some of the stuff meant work was transferred back to you mean that you had to up your game again?
It's a good question. I think it could have led to some skill atrophy. I think the main thing was to recognize when the indications in the head-up display were giving you garbage. Let's say, and one of the challenges in particular for mud moving was that the head-up display in the GR1 gave you time early late indication, but with a simple carrot, as it was called. So the carrot in the middle showed that you were on time. And full scale to the right was that you were early by 30 seconds or more, and to the left, late by 30 seconds or more. So there's the Tornado Force lived and died by being on track and on time, and having a plan that gave timing reference points to either keep you in the right formation or to achieve weapons over target separation was a real core skill for especially lead navigators to come up with. Fast forward to the GR4, we had the benefit of a digital output that said, right, you're 33 seconds late. So that would have been off scale before, but now you had a real accurate indication of exactly how late you were going to be. And also you had, this is your current ground speed, and this is the demanded ground speed to get you to the next waypoint on time. So you let's say your planned speed for the ground for that leg was 420 knots. That's our typical long route speed, and we usually step up in 30 knot increments as we approach the attack run. If you're flying such that you're on time for the waypoint at 420 knots, you're on track on time, and this other button we had called timeline would say you're on the timeline. But you could be flying 450 knots and time early late is saying yes, you're going to get to the next waypoint in time, but the reality is you're behind that egg, that place which represents timeline zero. You're behind it, but catching it up. So you could make much more informed decisions. Is that achievable ground speed? If he answers yes, yeah, you just push it up, 5, 4, 50 knots, get back on time, get to the next waypoint. Yeah, you'll need to then drop back to the planned ground speed of 420 as you go around the turn. Losing speed in the tornado was never a problem. You could always do that. Never an issue. But if you could see the demanded ground speed was 500 knots, well, you're going, okay, that's yes, it's achievable, but it's not really sensible. I'm so far behind. It's better to kind of cut the corner. So in terms of these skills fade, or the it's kind of recognizing, okay, my head-up display is saying I'm off scale. The backseat did have a bit more information. He could say, yeah, we're 31 seconds late. Oh, okay, so yeah, we're not, it's not horrific. And there could be some sort of discussion about, well, how about re-steer to the next waypoint? Let's see if that's any better. And it just became very comm intensive. And I think, as alluded to in part one, really, I think the key thing is making comm clear, concise, correct, timely. So don't talk any more than you need to. I mean, one of the things you see from some of the Gulf War footage, and it's no disrespect to the people involved, they were clearly under a lot of pressure, and it's no kidding, for real. But the phrase "nothing on the RHWR," mate, I can see it, right? You are talking over potentially important inter-flight chat or AWACS broadcast. So, maybe in a, I've certainly picked up this from the Eagle guys that really work super hard on having correct comm, and they go back through to tapes, making sure you use the correct brevity code word. It's the right time, on the right frequency. It's just so important, because it could, if it's not done well, it can really chip away at SA, not only for you, but you could be talking over somebody's defending call on strike primary or something like that.
It's a bit of a rabbit hole, but let's go down it quickly then. Is there an expectation though that it all goes to shit when you go to combat for the first time for real? I think all the Eagle guys that I talked to, I mean, Hacker Haskin, who's been on this channel, he said to me he did all this training, and then when he got shot at, I think it was a Roland that shot at him, and it was really close, and he said his threat call and all that stuff was just garbage. It just was none of the things that he was supposed to say. It was just terrible, even though in peacetime he could do it absolutely perfectly. And he got shot at a few times by SAMs, and I think probably over time, he didn't get comfortable with it, but that part of things improved. But is there an expectation then that when you go into combat that those things probably will be some of the first things that don't go according to plan, the comm?
I think the harder you work on it in peacetime, the less marked the deterioration is going to be. So is the guy you're talking about, is he a C model guy? Or
Striking.
Strike Eagle, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they work on it as well. I think the harder you work on it in peacetime, the more embedded the habit patterns are likely to be. But as far as, plan surviving first contact with the enemy, I think one of the key things on, the tornado mud moving planning was the loser plot. So having, what happens if, one aircraft goes US, US being like unserviceable on the ground, for example, or it's an airborne dropout, for whatever reason, gets to the push point, and it's got a failure that stops them crossing into enemy territory. Having a simple, easily understood, and executable plan is absolutely key. Knowing what your min force assets, like what's my min OCA that I can accept. So if their tank goes down, I mean, I can remember one time when an Eagle blew some tires out on takeoff or landing, and it just blocked the runway, and stopped other assets getting airborne. So you've got to have a plan that is easily digestible, and you go, right, yeah, we've talked about this. If this happens, then we're going to do that. So that's a key thing. So I think that helps with the kind of the fog of war, as it were. But I think, yeah, the rest of it, I don't know to what extent, when you come back from a live shooting war mission. So the stuff I did whilst I got weapons away was, it was clear of Gulf War One and Gulf War Two. Do you run the tapes and dissect it to the nth degree? From what I've read about, in particular, because I've been interested in the guerrillas, and their campaign in the first Gulf War. They were up against crew rest and things like that. They were flying their asses off. So the last thing you're going to do is dissect every single call and things like that. So I think the answer is they're probably not. I think the discussion point would come up if it had a knock-on effect, a second order effect. Well, did you realize that when you did that, this happened? So yeah.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
No. I think, that's pretty much it, really. I think as long as it's doesn't have a major knock-on effect. I think the Tornado Force were very good at improvising when things went wrong. Yeah, and that was kind of a necessity, because the aircraft wasn't particularly reliable. How can we work around this? We didn't have the largest number of assets to train with as well. So how can we improvise to train for that particular scenario? So improvisation was very much part of life in the RAF at that time.
I suppose that goes back a little to the question I was asking. So we're still in the rabbit hole. We'll come back out in a minute, but it comes back a little to the question I was asking earlier about lessons learned from Desert Storm. You know, 4 or 5 years prior to you turning up to the Tornado for your first frontline tour, and I know exactly the tape you're talking about, where the nav saying, "Yeah, nothing on the RHWR, 10 seconds to go, keep going." You know, and he's sort of. It's sort of it's almost like a soothing thing. I don't know if it's soothing for the pilot or for him, you know, and he's saying, you know, we've got an indication on the right, keep going, whatever, you know, chaff, chaff, chaff. And there's that whole narration of what's going on. So was that then just how they did things then? Would that have been one of the changes that took place between it happening and you arriving in the Tornado world?
You know, I don't think so. I think it's, you know, simply reflective of the amount of strain and stress the individual was under. You know, I can remember reviewing one of my tapes with it was a Paveway, low-level Paveway 3 simulated attack, and flying with a very capable backseater. And we ran the tape and it was quiet. And he'd done a tour on the Tornado F3 as a backseater there before coming across to the GR. And it was just really nice and quiet. And I just think that's the way to go. You know, your comm has to add value. It wasn't really something that was labored on the either the conversion unit or on the front line. It was perilously easy to transmit on the wrong radio from the GR1 because you had to push down a stalk to select one radio. You could simulcast if both stalks were down, but if you wanted to make an internal call just within your formation and you had your radio set up to speak on strike primary, you'd have to, you know, I want to talk, by just, you know, reaching in and maybe knowing where the stalks were, you just podging the button and the spring wasn't great. So was that, I pushed it down, did it come up? No, I'm not sure. And it was easy to commit comms crimes by talking on the wrong radio. Subsequently, on the GR4, we had a press to transmit switch, which allowed it was much easier, you know, press forward for the one radio, back for the other. And to simulcast, you would have to push the transmit switch on the throttle. Because both stalks were down, but the one on the stick top allowed you to choose the radio, and it was far, far better. I think we could have been more rigorous with debriefing comms crimes on the fleet, is my opinion. But
what other improvements then to your life as a front seater did the GR4 bring? I was interested when you were talking in part one about the recovery procedure from the loft, and you said, you know, one of the things that you have with the HUD is that it moves so quickly you don't really know, was that the 10, you know, 10 degrees or 20 degrees pitch mark or whatever. Yeah. And I think about the Strike Eagle HUD and you know, the fact that it has an angled set of pitch ladders that they have a little tick that point towards the horizon. So there are some nice visual cues that you could instantly pick up on. And that I'm not a Strike Eagle pilot, as you know, so that doesn't mean that it would be any better in the situation you're talking about. And then I think about the fact that the Tornado HUD has some sort of trend indications in terms of the circles or the little pointer that goes round, so you can kind of see what your rate of acceleration or descent is or whatever. And so I think about the differences in HUD philosophies and design decisions. But did any of that change with the GR4? What came in that made life easier for you?
Yes, one thing that really struck me when I returned to the GR4 from the Hawk was that there was just so much more information on the HUD. It was a wider angle installation in the first place. But I felt quite saturated with the information. I'd come back from legacy instruments, you know, just looking down at a standard instrument, blind flying instrument cluster, TACAN, HSI, you know, combined, fairly limited. So all of a sudden there's all this other stuff. And it was just a bit of data overload initially. But of course you just get better as you settle in, get back onto the aircraft and you're completing your refresher course, you get better at picking out the right information at the right time. And that's, I think that's the balance all aircraft designers and people looking at software upgrades have to strike, is like, okay, how much, if computer processing power isn't the issue, how much more information do you want in any given display? And do you want to declutter it sometimes or have the ability to declutter it? So we did see some changes. Obviously GR1 to GR4 was a big step change in the amount of information that we could get, and generally digitized was better. And latterly, We got some software features from the Tornado F3, like you might have been alluding to the SCP bars. So the SCP bar, if you're a straight and level, and if you push the throttles forward, the SCP bars would climb. So if you wanted to hold the speed that you were at, you just pitch the flight path vector to be a beam the SCP bars. That's great. If you wanted a level acceleration, then you can accept you're flying straight and level, the SCP bars climb as you accelerate, but then when you get to the speed that you want to be at, all you have to do is reduce the thrust until the SCP bars come back a beam the wings of your flight path vector. So it's absolute it's easy peasy for weapons employment, get on speed, and that's the power I need to sustain that speed. It was brilliant. The origin for those particular indications was in the combat scenario. So if you go into a rate fight, and once you've achieved, if you're flying faster than you wanted to, then you could just make sure your flight path vector or velocity vector was above the SCP bars, and then when you got to the G and alpha limit coincident, you just park your flight path vector on those bars, and it's going to keep you there, and then you're on the ideal rate fight to base. So that's just an example of the sort of stuff that came in, where either with the upgrade to the GR4 or on subsequent software issues.
That's specific excess power, isn't it? That's what SCP stands for. Okay. What about the nav flare? Because you've got under the nose is there's the LRMTS.
As you've got on the picture behind you, the two pods underneath the chin of the aircraft, the left hand one is the forward looking infrared, and the right hand one is the LRMTS, so laser ranging mark target seeker. So the LRMTS was on the GR1 as well, and if you look at the nose of an RAF Jaguar, that was also the kind of chisel nose on the front of that is very similar. So I believe it had the same equipment in that, and but the FLIR was new to the GR4, so it came at the cost of one of the 27 millimeter cannon. But the main benefit for it really was, I think, for the back seater to have a view out the front of the aeroplane, albeit in the IR range. They got to see the full head-up display symbology. The origin of the update itself was to give the Tornado a covert low-level ingress capability, so you could put the terrain following radar to standby. You could be flying on the night vision goggles, and if it was a low illumination night, then you could start to use the projection of the FLIR on the head-up display, and the guys in the back could also manipulate target weapons aiming using the FLIR. So I have to say I didn't find the FLIR projection on the head-up display particularly helpful. I found it was much better if I caught it up on the multifunction display between my knees. The resolution was much, much better there. So I would tend to use the NVGs, and then with a quick glance down to the FLIR to what I could see there if I needed it. And the HOTAS functionality allowed you to cycle through the different TV screens or the different display options on that screen. I mean, to just unpack the LRMTS a little bit, it was the primary height sensor, as far as the weapons instructors were concerned, for the Tornado. What it offered you was solving your bombing triangle. So effectively, that is a trigonometric calculation. If you know the depression angle of the laser head and the range of the target, you can solve your height above the target, which is something the airplane needs to know for the accurate release of weapons. If you don't have the right height above target, your weapons will either go short if you're lower than you think you are, or they'll go long if you're higher, because the weapons will just fly further before they hit the ground. The issue was that it wasn't eye safe, so there's only certain ranges that we could train with that system, and only certain targets and certain lines of attack that we could do it, because of backscattering of laser energy and stuff like that. So with those limitations, and the fact that it wasn't day-to-day mission critical equipment, we if it didn't work, it was one of those things, our laser doesn't work again, okay, we will aircrew accept it and carry it as a fault or something like that. But in terms of certainly on the GL1, solving your height channel problems, that was the way to do it. An attack run from the back seat on a radar significant target was called a phase one attack. And if the laser was working, the laser was going to be bore sighted to the radar, and you solve your bombing triangle, your height sensors, everything is taken care of, and you're well away. But if you can't use that, you're then falling back on a barometric height sensor or using the Rad-Alt if the target was a sea level target or you're at the same elevation as it, or using some air to ground ranging from the GMR, all of which were, the higher the dive angle, the more sketchy they became. And it's never something they fully got to grips with the software issues, unfortunately, as far as I saw. Having GPS, the advent of GPS, the aircraft knew where it was in 3D space. It knew that it had a terrain database around it, and if you knew the target elevation, then it solved the whole bombing triangle passively. But by that stage, of course, we were into precision guided weapons. But the other side to the LRMTS that was really useful is target acquisition. Really, in low level CAS, high threat close air support, you have, as I think they're seeing over Ukraine, you have to hit the target first time. There's no room for re-attacks. And if a forward air controller can put a laser spot on the target, that just, especially with employing dumb weapons, gives you an opportunity to acquire the target for that first run attack. Otherwise, you're relying on a verbal description, which is just so much more difficult. And to kind of then be able to acquire the target in enough time to overlay the weapon symbology, maybe adjust the aim point, fire a height sensor like the laser, and achieve a successful weapons release parameter. But the LRMTS would have made that just so much more achievable in a high threat close air support situation with dumb weapons.
You mentioned Ukraine, so here's a ridiculous hypothetical then. So, if we were just at the point now of retiring the Tornado, we aren't. We retired it years ago. But if we were just at the point of doing it, would it make a suitable platform for Ukrainian, I don't know, Su-24 pilots to come over and do some training on? There's a question, of course, at the moment about the F-16, and the US apparently has said in principle yes, but we haven't seen it yet. There are some NATO countries who fly the F-16 who are saying they'll do the training. The Ukrainians are saying they've been flying flight simulators, high fidelity flight study simulators, to get ahead of the curve a little. Could you do the same with a Tornado, or is it just too complicated to do in the same sort of time frame as you could do a 4.5 gen glass cockpit jet?
Yeah, I think it would be feasible just as a kind of initial take on it. Mainly because I think the fencer, the Su-24, is a similar sort of generation to the Tornado. Obviously, the main difference is that the fencer's got a side-by-side seating arrangement, so there'd be some adjustment to a tandem seating arrangement. I think the main thing that the Tornado would bring to the party is legacy Brimstone or some of the other smart weapons. How aware are you of the Brimstone weapon system overall?
I've been to 41 Squadron at Coningsby, and they've shown me the videos of it, so I'm familiar with it.
Okay, so for I guess for the viewers then, think of it as like a Hellfire sized missile, roughly, something looking similar to that, that's got its own seeker and some algorithms that can help it to identify military targets, broadly speaking. And it was designed for a Cold War scenario, which we thought never going to happen. Where were we ever going to get the rules of engagement to employ this, semi-smart weapon that's going to make its own engagement decisions? But they did use it in Libya. There was one attack that I know of that used the legacy Brimstone against a tank park, as far as I know. And I don't know how effective it was. I knew one of the backseaters who was a weapons instructor who got seconded to do that attack. But that particular weapon system would be ideal because you don't have to overfly the target. You could get to an engagement range, fire the weapons off in a mode that allows it to search for a column of tanks or a frontage of tanks, and it's going to make those autonomous engagement decisions without the crew having to overfly it. Now, it's not a massive standoff, but it's still better than overflying to drop dumb weapons. And so I think the Tornado would offer would offer that. Obviously, anything above very low level is highly contested airspace, and so the airframe limitations are likely to be similar to what the fencer is experiencing. And the footage that I've seen open sources, those guys are right down on the deck, and they need to be. There's nowhere to hide. It seems to be fairly flat terrain wise. So in terms of platform survivability, it would be similar. But I think the weapon systems like the Brimstone would be ideal for dealing with, support to frontline troops and things like
I think we've definitely gone off the beaten track now, but
that.
I think we gave them the first generation Brimstone. I think they were launching them from cargo containers and things like that. But because they were, and I think there was even sort of a milk van or some kind of vehicle that was disguised as a milk float, and then they were sort of dropping the ramp and shooting them from there. And I think they were striking ship targets with them, all sea targets or something like that. But anyway, this is a while back. So, okay, that's interesting. So, there was one thing that you mentioned then. So you talked about 1553 data bus, and I wonder whether or not that was the aim, the GR1A, and then you got 1764, the GR4, or whether or not GR4 was 1553.
I think I did a quick look at this, and I seem to remember it 1553, and then just the open source stuff that I'd looked at just this morning to remind myself so I didn't embarrass myself. It said 1553, so that's my recollection of it. And that obviously does allow interaction between the crew and the avionics and the smart weapon that's underneath the airplane. So that was a major step forward. It got around the requirement to have a control panel for a particular for every single weapon. There was still a targeting pod control panel and things like that, but it did obviate that need. And so you could put coordinates into a weapon, read them back, and adjust them. And obviously, when you get onto Paveway 4, you could change other weapons, fuse settings, impact angles, all sorts of other stuff that you can do with Paveway 4. So yeah, it was a major step forward, really.
And it's interesting to hear then your thoughts on the NAVFLIR, because I just assumed it was something that would have parity with the system that the Strike Eagle uses, where I think those guys feel fairly comforted by being able to look through the HUD and see a pretty good picture. There's some slight parallax error, I understand, that's a bit odd, but certainly a system that I think is fairly well regarded. But were you alone in not being that impressed with the representation in the HUD, or was that a general sense?
I am not sure. I just know. I mean, I did do the manual low flying on MVGs, and I just found that the important thing is to get the HUD brightness set correctly to be able to see the background through the MVGs without gaining the goggles back. So if the symbology is too bright, the goggles are going, oh, this is too much, and you can't see the terrain and the texture and the obstructions, most importantly, so clearly behind. So I found that when you had to use a different part of the projection system, as I recall, to project the FLIR image onto the head-up display combiner glass, and it just wasn't all that. I found, yeah, by far my preference was to look on the screen below. I mean, the other time it worked really well was in poor visibility, so like dust or haze, you could see through that. But fog, no, as you can imagine, that attenuates IR energy, so it's no good in those conditions. But yeah, I just didn't find it that good. I mean, one of the other good things it could do, of course, is thermal cueing. So I was an aggressor pilot later. So by that, in RAF parlance, that's flying Red Baron type mission. So a basic threat emulation, nothing to the aggressor level that you hear about at Nellis or whatever. But basically being able to engage the formation in a safe manner to kind of stimulate threat reactions that were appropriate. So did they do the right thing for a beam engagement, a stern engagement, and basic stuff like that. But the FLIR was very good for trying to get tally too. So you're rolling in with a height split for safety as you approach the track line that the pair of the four ship are flying. But you could tip in from height and have your head-up display pointed where they're supposed to be, and then the thermal cues would be jumping around the engine, so that could help you get tally. Okay, there's tally one. Right, if they're in card, the leader or wingman is going to be over there or over there, and you can start to pick up the rest of the formation based on the permutations of different formations they could be flying. So that was the other great thing about the FLIR, in my opinion. Just not, I'm not sure how the how it was projected on the strike eagle. Maybe it was just a better fidelity, or maybe it was just me. I don't know.
So you've explained the rationale for the GR4 upgrade and that covert low level capability. Does that suggest then you were still doing a lot of low level flying, even though, there's the old adage, isn't there, about sort of training for the last war that you fought, and the last war we fought, we were doing everything at medium altitude and it wasn't particularly demanding. And then we went and sort of got involved. I guess this was more towards the end of your time on a frontline squadron, at least. We were in Afghanistan and none of that was low level. But so it suggests that you were doing some low level. I wondered, and maybe what we'll do is we'll break after this and we'll do a part three if you're up for it, where we'll come back and we'll talk about, you've already dropped a hint about your ejection. But one thing we haven't talked about is the fact you were also a SEAD pilot in the GR4. The GR4 could fly the sort of, well, Weasel mission, carry the alarm anti-radiation missile. We haven't talked about any of that. So for anybody who's listening thinking, why would I tune into part three? That's why you would tune into part three, because Nick will talk about those things. But before we do that, could you talk a little bit about using the aeroplane and the TF system? Did you do a lot of manual TF? Was it always manual TF? Was it auto TF? What capabilities did the aeroplane have in that regime?
So of course, when that the aircraft first came into service as the GR1, it was really designed around the terrain following radar system coupled to the autopilot, which allowed you to set hard, medium, and soft rides and different set clearance heights, or effectively the height you fly above the terrain from 1500 down to 200 feet. And that was with, as I say, with the autopilot coupled. So you could disconnect the autopilot and you'd have a flight director prompt telling you to climb or descend based on the terrain it was seeing in front of you. Very comm intensive. Generally speaking, the backseater would have his radar bore sighted and would be dealing with longer range terrain contacts that he would then hand off to the front seat at about 5 or 6 miles. That was when it would start to paint on the e-scope in the front. So for e-scope, think looking at the aeroplane with the terrain in front of it from the side, like a cross-section view. And it basically allowed the pilot to anticipate the flight director commands you were going to see. There were a couple of lines depicted. One was the zero command line, which if terrain penetrated, you should expect to see a response from the aircraft. Now, the shape of that line would be determined by how fast you're flying or how hard the ride is that you've got set or how low you want to fly. So clearly, if you wanted to fly 500 foot rather than 200 foot, then the aircraft needs to climb earlier. And if you're soft doing a soft ride, then again it needs to climb earlier at less G to achieve the terrain separation. So the sort of commentary might be, okay, got a ridge at 10 miles, ridge at 5 miles, and at that point I would say in the front seat, yeah, okay, I got that on the e-scope. And then as you get close, maybe penetration at 2 miles, aircraft responds, so you'd see the autopilot command a climb, because most of the time we had the autopilot connected, and then the aircraft would climb. And when the terrain response went below the zero command line, you say demand satisfied, you'd expect the aircraft to start to bunt over to achieve the set clearance height you've got on over the top of the ridge. So that's how that e-scope should go. The other line on that e-scope is called the CRAM, which is clearance range ahead monitor. Bad things were happening if the terrain response went through that. The aircraft should have responded by that point, and so generally speaking, it might jolt itself into life and do something about it, or you might be forced to do an emergency low level pull up. The sort of situations where that might happen would be in sand or snow. Sometimes the terrain following radar didn't see snow quite as well or sand quite as well, so that might have been situations which I have seen where day VMC we had the TF in the desert and it would have flown us at a ridge, so I had to sort of disconnect that. But in certain areas you might choose to increase the set clearance height for that. Other comm really was reassurance for the navigator that the right modes were engaged. So we would be talking about T dot, E dot, and five cells. So the T shows that you've got the flight director part of the autopilot connected to the TFR, not a cruise mode, just for maintaining straight and level. So the T says that. The dot is that it's in showing that the flight director's engaged and the autopilot's engaged. The E dot is a test pulse on the e-scope, and it kind of was displayed every time the scanner hit one end of the stops. Five cells was to do with the autopilot moding, which was depicted in the picture that you can see over your shoulder, Steve. The left-hand glare shield had a row of autopilot selection modes, which include the terrain following radar. So the back seater could kind of peer over the side of the ejection seat, and with practice, he knew the pattern of green lights illuminated that he was expecting to see.
That's cool.
So that's the kind of the basic mode of operation for the GR1 and GR4 in TF operations. The beauty of the TFR also allowed us to gain experience of the phenomena that you see under night vision goggles without having to miss the ground. So we'll worry about that. So I understand for Harrier and Jaguar guys, they didn't have this, so they would fly the route by day and then fly the route at maybe 1,000 feet and then sort of step it down. And generally, be obviously forced to fly on nights with good illumination with a good moon. So we talk about millilux levels. Anything above 10 was pretty good, but we could be flying in really dark nights down at 1 millilux, half a millilux, when you're really relying on cultural lighting, so street lights to kind of boost the light levels because there's no moon or it's obscured by cloud or something like that. So it was a great stepping stone to getting to the fully manual night vision goggle based visual flying at low level, which was brilliant. It was very challenging but very rewarding. And so the GR4 upgrade allowed you to bridge the gap between that manual flying and the fully coupled terrain following that was done by the GR1 all the time. And so it would go like this pretty much. You might get yourself step down on the terrain following down to kind of a peacetime 250 foot set clearance height. And then the HOTAS allowed you to disconnect the autopilot, turn off the flight director and put the TF to standby. And that would leave a certain pattern of lights on the glare shield. So there you are, then you're flying, just regular manual flying, but obviously on the goggles at night. So let's say that you go under a cloud bank and that illumination levels deteriorate and you're starting to find it hard to see up ahead. Well, if you need to do that, you could just, using one of the buttons on the HOTAS, get the TF transmitting again, look at the e-scope and go, right, it is that terrain penetrating the zero command line? Do I need to be climbing right now? Ideally, you'd probably put the flight director up as well, and it would say how much to climb. But you could then manually terrain follow using the cues from the autopilot and from the terrain following radar. And as soon as you cleared that ridge, you could then put everything back to standby and you're covert again. But if the weather's really rubbish and you can't, well, you weren't supposed to do this in peacetime because of airspace rules and sort of night weather limits. But if the weather was really poor, then you just fully engage the terrain following radar and just punch through it, get out the other side, take it out, and you're back into manual flying. The issues were with the terrain following radar is that the aircraft could only turn at a certain rate, so the turn radius with the terrain following radar engaged was wider. Well, and the mission planning system allowed you to select that. So depending on your planned ground speed, whether you made it a visual turn or a terrain following turn, then the radius turn could be quite significant. So if you're hand flying, it just basically meant rather than droning around a 30-degree bank turn or something like that, you 45-degree bank turn, you just delay the turn and then fly a visual 60-degree, 70-degree turn to intercept the originally planned outbound track from that waypoint. So a great system, but there were dragons, and the dragons were really about correct sequence of switchology. So if you were flying around with the TF in standby, you had to get the TF transmitting first, then select the flight director. You'd get the T in the HUD and the flight director dot, and then put the autopilot in. if you did not put the TF on first, but put the flight director up and then engage the autopilot, you've got the autopilot in a cruise mode, which is just used for medium level. You're going to fly straight into the ridge that's in front of you. So getting that right was really important. And that was something that was really emphasized in terms of the CRM. So yeah, I mean, that's the kind of the GR4 upgrade in a nutshell, what it really gave for you in terms of the covert EO ingress capability, because you could find targets on the flare as well and engage them without broadcasting on the radar. As long as you could see them visually, you could fire the laser as the height sensor, having put the reticle over the target from the front, from the back seat, and solve your bombing triangle that way for dumb weapons. So yeah, it was great. And obviously this 1553 data bus that we've talked about, but the hardware, the aircraft itself hadn't, the airframe, the engines, that sort of stuff hadn't really changed.
So what was the scenario then, the specific scenario that the RAF was envisaging when it came up with this GR4 capability then? That you were going to go sort of marauding across, so the modern day equivalent of the folder gap, looking for armor targets on your own and engage them in the dead of night?
I think the main thing that was likely to require the covert ingress was the capability of TFR jamming. I think, to recognize that if you've got your TF illuminating, that you're going to have people aware that you're coming and where you're coming from. So just that ability to maneuver. When I was at the end of my first tour, there a small cadre of people were cleared to manually NVG, but a lot of the lighting in the aircraft wasn't compliant, and that could give issues with the goggles and things like that. And there wasn't the HOTAS integration for the TF, so that plugging the TFR in and disengaging it would all have been through the glare shield controls. So the last thing you need to be doing is, like, okay, weather's getting rather poor, can't quite see what's going on, then shifting your focus from the goggles to close in at maybe some lighting that's not EO compatible, getting the right switch selections in a hurry and getting it engaged in a safe and timely manner. That would have been a lot more challenging in the GR1. So I think it's simply a fact that the requirement had been written towards the end of the Cold War, and it just took quite some time to get it procured and into service. That by the time we got it, and I flew my first GR4 right at the end of my time on 617, so it was 2000. But even then, the Cold War was kind of long gone. And that capability, it's a fair question to ask, what was the relevance of it? But fortunately, a lot of the smart weapon employment came with it. I remember that flight that I did, because the aircraft had come straight from Wharton. The harmonization of the radar and everything was spot on. So I was flying with a very good navigator who'd flown everything from Vulcans to Tornado via the Buccaneer. He's a weapons instructor, and yeah, he got a great mark on the target, and the bomb was a DH, a direct hit. So the harmonization was super tight, and it was just great when it's come out of the factory. Everything worked as per the brochure. It was lovely.
Final question for me then before we wrap up this part then, Nick. You talk in a very casual way about turning everything off, looking through the night vision goggles. If it gets a bit dark, or you go under a cloud bank or whatever and you lose your illumination, you just put the TF back on, look at the e-scope, make sure that if it's going through the set clearance plane that you're maneuvering, and maybe turn on the flight director if you want to know how much you've got to maneuver by in order to miss the ridge. Is that the level of sort of capability and competence and comfort that you would get to operate the system with? I mean, to me, that sounds scary. You're doing that at night, and there's a set of steps you've got to go through. There's the possibility that if you screw up the HOTAS, you're going to turn the airplane into it's going to fly straight into the hill because it's in the cruise mode rather than flying the TF. Is that part of just being a Tornado guy that you have to just take it with that level of coolness? Did you ever get comfortable with it? Were you uncomfortable with it?
I think I try to engage the TFR, so by day, and try to go through that switch selection, just make it good habit patterns. And when I was doing pilot checks on people, I would potentially get them to do that by day just to practice it. I mean, there was a currency before you night flew, you should have been to TFR current by day. And I seem to remember the currency lasted 30 days. So it's like anything, the building block approach, crawl, walk, run. So let's do it by day. And then we move on to doing it by night. And if you practice by day and you practice it often enough, I always made sure the initial engagement had to be via the glare shield. And then you'd step down the set clearance height with the rad alt as well and get yourself down. But I just made sure that whenever I could use the HOTAS that I did use it and just became really comfortable with it that way. But I think it's like anything, if you became casual, you thought you couldn't mess it up, then you were more likely to mess it up. But as always, it's if you've dug yourself a hole, it's the important thing is to know how to get yourself out of it. And the answer to that was there was an instinctive cutout paddle switch on the front of the stick, which you would disconnect everything. So you would just hit that instinctive cutout paddle switch and pull up, and then make sure you did the right the a full re-engagement through the glare shield controls. Yeah, that was the way to go. So I just yeah, night flying on just the TFR with all the autopilot connected was quite mundane. It was won or lost in the plan. If the plan was solid and you got your timing reference points in the contract sorted, then it was a non-event, generally speaking. You'd fly the route. It was an exercise in keeping the time early late indications centered. Of course, on one leg you've got a 20 knot crosswind, but you need to anticipate if you're about to turn into that 20 knot crosswind, especially if you know that the next leg is an acceleration as well. So it's that kind of air picture and just thinking ahead that was required. But flying manual MVGs was never dull because it was just so much more challenging, so much more fun. The reality of trying to visually acquire a target on MVGs and put a dumb weapon or an unguided weapon onto it, I think it's another issue altogether, unless it was a pretty sizable target. But of course, with the advent of either sort of Brimstone or Enhanced Paveway 2, GPS guided LGBs, which you could toss on to a set of coordinates. The thing was really about getting in, making the most of all the terrain that you could see, flying up of the earth in a way that perhaps the TFR plan didn't allow you to, but you couldn't find, you'd had to choose a mean line of advance. You couldn't find every crease in the valley, which you could do with the manual flying. So yeah, just as they say, train hard, fight easy, and the more you train, the more comfortable you get. But be comfortable, don't get casual.
Thanks for tuning in to 10% True. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to subscribe, and if you're on YouTube, hit the bell button to make sure you get notified of the next episode. Thanks and take care.